Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver.
Boy, lose the legendary status, then you forget what to say.
I know. This is the one final show until summer hiatus initiates, and that abbreviates out to Of Sushi.
Of Sushi.
In your honor, this is our show Of Sushi.
I love it. Smelly fish.
Our sushi show, as a matter of fact.
Do you like sushi?
No. You know I hate sushi.
Have you ever eaten sushi?
I hate it so much. No.
So, you're one of those people.
I can't even smell sushi.
Well, what if it's made out of cucumber?
I eat cucumber. I don't consider cucumber sushi.
But it is, because it's wrapped in seaweed.
See, now you're trying to define. See, you're defining sushi. I know sushi, raw fish.
No, that's not true. Sushi is not raw fish. It can be raw fish, but it's not always raw fish.
Right, but you have to go past raw fish to get to the cucumbers of the sushi.
No,
it's not like say, oh, I'll have vegetarian sushi.
Nope, I have one of the normal rolls I have is a shrimp tempura roll, which means the shrimp is deep fried.
Yeah, I understand that there's that other stuff, but I'm saying if you go to a sushi place, they serve raw fish.
They can serve it, yes. Only if you ask for it.
Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and a special radio wave to the staff at the MSU Ronald G. Eglin Space Science Center. My co-medical host, Shelley Irving, is off in Isonville today doing...
How many shows a year do you have to miss before you get booted?
Doing the paperwork. Rick is lobbying for a replacement. If you feel that you are stupid enough to be a replacement, just send us your name on Facebook and we'll at least take a look at you. But Shelley will be back.
I think you strategically place her between you and I so that I don't smack you more often.
Rick is giving me the intensive stare right now. And in order to break that up, I'm going to call upon him to tell you how to access our show on the internet.
Well, Tony, you can get to the show at the Moorhead State Public Radio website. That's WMKY.org. There is a section there. You have to do a little searching in the menus for Health Matters. Get to the location where Health Matters is stored. You'll see a list of the most recent shows that comes with a summary, but most importantly, it comes with a link to listen to the audio of the show. That's an MPEG file, so it's a standard audio file that you can listen on any device. Click on it, listen to it over and over and over and over. And then after you're done and you've decided, you know, this one-way stuff just doesn't cut it for me, I want to talk back to this show, jump over to Facebook, facebook.com/HMRadioShow. There you will find the fan page for Health Matters. It's not all those other Health Matters shows that people talk about. There's some other podcasts out there and some other shows named Health Matters, but ours is right there at HM Radio Show. And there you can interact with us. It's staffed by us. We kind of look at it. We respond to it. We post to it on a regular basis. It's your opportunity to interact with the cast and crew of Health Matters. All you got to do is tell us what you like, what you don't like. Maybe there's a show topic you have in mind. Maybe there's something we said that was funny. Maybe there was something we said that wasn't funny. I don't know. Some of you just call the station manager directly. That isn't the way to do it. Go to Facebook.com and tell us there, because that way we'll hear it. And anyway, you can get all of that good fun can be found at Facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor for today's show, Primary Prevention of Heart Disease. Now, the cardiologists, Rick, have gotten cute. This is like...
They weren't already cute?
Not many cardiologists I know are cute. That was a real slap, wasn't it? You goaded me into that. I think cardiologists,
you fell for that.
There are good looking cardiologists just throughout the region.
Going back to the whole fish thing, you know, I hooked you on that one pretty easy.
All right, but at any rate, the American Heart Association has gotten cute. We'll put it that way. The American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association has gotten cute. Now you remember the four basic food groups?
No,
you really don't remember.
Steak one of them?
Actually, that was meat. Yes. There was milk, bread, meat, vegetable, fruit.
You know, the thing is, the whole four categories thing, it feels like that used to be part of what's now the food pyramid. And all that stuff changes so much, it's hard to keep track of.
Right. So then what's the food pyramid, which I don't remember. In general, I could reconstruct the food pyramid, but I don't remember the sections of it. And then came MyPlate. Remember that? It was portion sizes and a fractional portion of the plate that should be devoted to each of these different foods. And you spent most of it, frankly, with vegetables.
So we've got the meat down. What's the other three?
Yeah.
Vegetables?
Vegetables. Well, in the original Ford food groups, it was vegetable, fruits, and it was milk and dairy, and it was breads.
Right.
But the thing was, that didn't lead to better nutrition. That sounded like you should eat as much bread as you should vegetables, and that's not true.
Okay. Yeah. If you say so.
Yeah.
You're the doctor here.
So we went to my plate. Well, here's what the cardiologist did. The cardiologist had Life's Simple Seven.
Oh, because that's easy to remember.
Right. Well, seven things. Don't smoke. Maintain a healthy weight. Maintain adequate physical activity. A balanced, healthy diet. And then achieve target values for three things: cholesterol, blood pressure, and glucose.
But well, right. If you do the first four, doesn't the other three take care of himself?
Mostly. Yes.
So really, you only got to do four things there. Well, they're just exaggerating because that's what they do.
But see, the American Heart Association, even if you are a physically active, healthy diet, correct weight, non-smoker, if you're a male in your 50s, they're going to put you on cholesterol medicine based on your cardiac risk. So you achieve target values, not normal values, not average values, none of that, target values for those. So that's what they did. They had these four things. They call them seven things. They call them Life Simple Seven. Well, now we have the ABCs of primary cardiovascular prevention. This is their 2019 update. It was released May 1st, and I just kind of let it sit on the shelf a while because it annoyed me. And then
you didn't think it was cute?
No, because nobody's going to remember these ABCs. I've got A, B, C, C, D, D, E.
Sounds like seven to me.
Yep. Yeah, well, pretty simple, pretty similar, you got to admit. All right, but it's a little bit different. A stands for assess risk and aspirin. And so it should be AA, shouldn't it?
Well, AA has a whole different meaning in medical.
Probably not the way they wanted to start their cardiac prevention, although a trip to AA would probably be good.
If you need to be there for that, yeah, it's probably pretty good.
You should be there. But the point is to assess risk. They have something, if you can use the Google to do this. If they there's something called the American Heart Association Risk Calculator. If you Google AHA Risk Calculator, then you can find this thing, and you can put in your blood pressure, your age, your smoking status, and your cholesterol numbers. And it will come up with a risk for you. And it is the 10-year risk of having a heart attack. This is a number that would be handy for you to know. We talk about the blood pressure, which, again, that carries some implications. We talk about the what the ideal cholesterol is. We talk about what the ideal body mass index is. Well, this is your, using those numbers, this puts together a 10-year risk of having a heart attack or a stroke. Now, as you might imagine, when you get up in your 60s, the 10-year risk of having a heart attack or stroke gets pretty high for all of us because many people, heart disease is the number one cause of death, and many people die in their 70s and in their early 80s due to heart disease. So it is very hard to get to those numbers without the American Heart Association recommending that you go on some type of medication. But at any rate, knowing your risk helps you plan how aggressively to treat your blood pressure and cholesterol and so forth. Now, the other part of A is aspirin. And it is, they said low-dose aspirin is now reserved for high-risk patients. At this point, they are not recommending low-risk across the board. They are recommending aspirin across the board, but they do recommend it for some people. And actually, I was trying to get to that risk, and that's why I messed up. But I don't have the risk factors for aspirin sitting right here in front of me. But it's aspirin.
We're just going to have to take your word for it on this one.
Yeah. If you are of average risk or if you are over age 80, then it is time. Over age 70, you should not be taking aspirin.
And that's all he had to say about that.
For adults 40 to 75 years of age, clinicians should use the equations to estimate the 10-year risk. And aspirin should be used infrequently and should be reserved for those high risk. B, blood pressure. Maintain your blood pressure below 130 over 80. Now, the heart doctors have been very aggressive with this. Most of us still use the 140 over 90 number. The heart doctors say you've got to maintain your blood pressure less than 130 over 80. It's a disagreement. They're looking at the same data. The heart doctors say, look, it's best for your heart if you go less than 130 over 80. The rest of us are going, well, yeah, but you're going to run into more side effects. You're going to pay a lot more money. You're going to divert your attention from other things that might be equally important. Pick who you trust.
Well, I'm going to go with whichever one I'm closer to.
Yeah. It is. You go, all right, which one fits me right now? Which
yeah,
one?
I'm under the 130 by the 130 over, you know, I'm going to deal with that one.
All right. So, again, based on risk, the first C stands for cholesterol. The second C stands for cigarettes. The cholesterol must be controlled to target levels based on your risk. The cigarettes must be thrown in the trash.
This thing's really confusing, Tony.
Well, I'm struggling with it right now. Yeah, because I was trying to pull off those aspirin.
I'm sitting
things.
Here thinking, you know, people are listening to us on the radio, and you have a visual in front of you.
Yeah.
You have a very visual circle with segmented areas with lots of words and letters, and it's very easy for you. But if you're not visualizing this, this is complex and hard, and
right.
Shame
and
on them for doing this.
This is the problem, isn't it? I mean, when you go back to the four basic food groups, which have been outdated now for probably around 30 years, I remember them because I grew up with them.
Right.
You go to my plate, I cannot tell you right now what's on my plate.
Well, I can tell you what's going to be on my plate later. Might be sushi.
It could very well be. But at any rate, all right, we're going to stop there with A, B, and C.
Thank
we'll go to
goodness.
D and E. D&E, actually in our next fractional portion, that is our sponsor. Primary Prevention, the 2019 update, according to the American College of Cardiology. Now, I know, Rick, you are a big fan of chatbots.
That's not really true. I know what they are. Do you know what they are?
I do.
Have you used one?
I have not used a chatbot.
So then how do you know what they are?
I'm reading it.
How have you experienced them?
Listen, I can read with the best of them. Put it that way. This is the National Health Service. This was the 23rd of May, 2019. The National Health Service is trying to improve their use of technology, and people in Birmingham, England, advised to use an online. They have live and also automated chat services, symptom checkers, and video consultations to help relieve the unsustainable pressure on their clinical services. That is, we simply cannot afford, we do not have the resources to take care of everyone, at least in the National Health Service in England, they don't. And so we need to take some pressure off. And so what they do is if you have some symptoms, you say, I have chest pain, and the chatbot says, oh, tell me more about your chest pain. And you said, well, it hurts. And the chatbot asks you a series of questions, and it says, you know, you probably need to go to the emergency room.
It doesn't say, let me consult my lawyer first, and then I'll answer that question?
No. That is, as you might imagine, in the United Kingdom, that's not as big an issue as it is in the United States.
Can you imagine what that chatbot would have to do in the U.S.? It would have to consult the attorney general before it gave you a response.
Now, I don't want to give you any definitive statement, but...
Right. We can neither confirm nor deny, but this would might be something you want to take a look at.
Yeah, we call it a mumblebot.
Yeah, it'll be, yeah. It'd be we're going to try not to go to jail, Bob.
Yeah, I think that. Well, what they say in 10 years, or they said in 10 years' time, we can get 70% of our outpatient appointments. Actually, they said within 2 to 3 years, 70% could be online, not necessarily live appointments.
Well, I think there's a good delineation here, though, or a good distinction, Tony. I think we need to make the distinction between what we could achieve and what we will achieve. Because a lot of times you read stuff like this and you naturally want to think, oh my gosh, we're going to be George Jetson in 3 years. Well, you know what? We may have the technology to pull off this whole chatbot thing, coupling it to something like a Watson or a Google and having it be self-learning. I mean, right now in tech, the big catchphrases are AI, ML, right? So artificial intelligence, machine learning, right? So everything's about getting smarter automatically and making decisions automatically. And great, there's going to be things we can do, but I'm telling you, the legal system and the essentially the social parameters we put around our country are just not ready for this.
The chief executive of the Health Trust in the United Kingdom said in 5 to 10 years' time, the way patients access and receive health care will be unrecognizable. And he considers that a good thing, which I think is an interesting thing. We're going to be unrecognizable during our break, so why don't you come back for our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the one final show until summer hiatus initiates. That's right. This is our last show until we take about a 1 month break. We are
which will
out
probably
for the
end
rest
up being more like 6 weeks.
We'll be out for the rest of June. We'll be back in mid-July.
Because there is this that 4th of July holiday that probably will somehow or another raise its head. I actually think it's on a Wednesday this year. Is that right? Wednesday, Thursday?
It is in midweek.
Yeah, it's a midweek holidays. I think it's Thursday.
Wow.
So, you know, who knows what that'll do.
But we will certainly, during that time, we will be busy at work doing absolutely nothing.
Well, Health Matters won't be doing anything.
That's right. But you'll come back and you can tell that we've done absolutely nothing for Health Matters when
we come
back.
It's a small Christmas for us.
Our sponsor for today's show, Primary Prevention of Heart Disease. Again, the American Heart Association has essentially updated their own heart pyramid into the My Heart Plate, and they're way past the four heart groups.
It looks like a train wreck.
Yeah, it looks like at least it's a very colorful train wreck.
I mean, if you put this up on your refrigerator, it'll look like your kid's homework.
Yeah, it does. Let's go back over it again. The letter A stands for Assess Risk using their online risk calculator, American Heart Association Cardiac Risk Calculator, or American Heart Association AHA Risk Calculator. You can find it. B is blood pressure. C is cholesterol. And also C is cigarettes. The latter should be eliminated. The former should be controlled. Blood pressure, there are two guidelines competing out there right now. The American College of Physicians says 140 over 90. The American Heart Association says 130 over 80. They're both looking at the exact same research studies. They are interpreting it in different ways. We're up to letter D. Letter D stands for diet weight. How much can you torture the alphabet? Emphasis on intake of vegetables, fruits, nuts, legumes, fish, preferably cooked. I added that part. And whole grains. And also maintaining your weight. I mean, let's face it. If you get fat on legumes, then that's your fault. That certainly we at Health Matters had nothing to do with that. But you need to maintain an ideal weight. Also, D stands for diabetes, control through diet and exercise. The first drug always for diabetes, if you're able to tolerate it, will be metformin. It is a dirt cheap drug, years old and very safe, and also one that is favorable in terms of helping you with your weight and helping you with your cardiac risk. That's the two Ds, diet, weight, and diabetes. E stands for exercise, 150 minutes a week, or that's, 30-minute sessions during the weekdays, or 75 minutes per week of vigorous physical activity. So I suppose if you decided you were going to panic, for instance, if you just had you ran down the street panicking, that would probably be vigorous. You could panic for 75 minutes a week, or you could work out in a disciplined fashion for 150.
I'll pass.
Okay.
And then, I'll worry about my diet weight instead.
Yeah, I know. So that is, in a circular, colorful fashion, the
can you describe
five
vigorous?
Letters. Vigorous.
I mean, what constitutes a vigorous workout?
Well, I think...
Is that playing around a golf?
I think, most of the time when we talk about moderate intensity exercise, we're talking about where you are breathing hard, but you're still able to talk and carry on a conversation.
Well, if I'm breathing hard, I can't talk.
Yeah.
Let's clear the air there.
Okay, so if you are breathing so hard that you cannot carry on a conversation, that would be vigorous exercise for you.
Okay.
Now, there are, you can look at pulse rates compared to age and so forth, but just a rough rule of thumb is.
And how long am I supposed to do that for?
If you can talk during your exercise, well, if you can talk 150 minutes, if you are exercising so hard that you really can't carry on a conversation, 75. So you can cut your exercise
after 15
minutes.
I'd be dead.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing that they mentioned.
It'd be a short conversation.
In their discussion of exercise, they say, you know, it's not like you can get up and do 30 minutes or 15 minutes of exercise and then just sit back in your chair the rest of the day. That exercise does not carry over. So you need to get out of your chair regularly anyway and do the exercise. It's just, that's what our body was meant to be in motion, and we're not doing that. So exercise does not allow you to spend the rest of the day in the chair. Our sponsor, the ABCs of Primary Cardiovascular Prevention, That's right. This is our 2019 update of the Simple 7 that came out a couple of years ago. Okay. We were talking about the chatbots, and Rick says, we are not ready. We are not willing to. The big question we've been asking over and over again is, would you trust this technology? Rick, last week, Shelley and I talked about the fact that there is an artificial intelligence that studied over 80,000 mammograms and theoretically now can predict your risk of breast cancer up to 5 years in advance. And the big question is, if the computer says your mammogram looks like you might have breast cancer in 5 years, would you believe it? Would you do something? Would you act on that from the computer?
But you know, and I hate to sound, I mean, it sounds horrible saying this, Tony, because I'm not trying to be against progress, right? Because we need progress. We need these things to change. But that the question you just asked had nothing to do with whether the patient's going to get the whatever procedure they might need. The question is whether the insurance is going to pay for it.
You've got that problem. I have not
seen... No, I'm just saying. That's the world we live in. And we talk about this at work all the time. People think IT... Some people think IT is, you know, can be really hard, but some people think it's really easy. They see it. They just think, well, it's easy. The thing is, the devil is always in the details. And in the U.S., social agreements with each other, you know, a.k.a. our government, each state's rules and regulations, we're just not ready for this kind of move. The you know, thousands and thousands of pages of rules and regulations were going to have to be rewritten for us to allow a computer to make a decision for a doctor to do a surgery and get billed for it and get paid for it.
See, I mean, you know that because you deal with these regulations day to day. I don't know that, but what I do know is that this computer theoretically can predict that, but we don't know what havoc we would loose if we decided that we were going to start operating based on a computer's recommendations for 5 years in the future. I mean, it may mathematically, statistically, that may be correct, but we've never actually done that in real practice. And to put people's health and lives in jeopardy based on computer recommendations that mathematically look good, well, I will tell you right now, you know, my job has been made miserable by the fact that we have an electronic medical record that was said to be vastly superior to anything we'd had before and yet has taken doctors completely away from patient care.
So do you see a day where a patient can go online, talk to a chatbot, and in 2 hours, Amazon delivers them prescription medication?
I do. I think that's going
to
happen.
That doesn't require a doctor to approve it. Because right now there's a big key. They may send it to your office, and you may have to virtually, electronically, somehow or another sign off and say, yep, go ahead and send that to that lady.
Yeah.
Because remove that one key step. And that's what has to happen for the automation really to take hold.
Right.
Because you're only as good as your availability in that scenario.
All right. I'll give you two examples. First of all, I do not see it happening completely independently. Right now we have something called computer-assisted diagnosis in mammograms where, you know, the computer is looking and it's supposed to be helping the physician. Now, it may be that computer could have made the diagnosis by itself, but they still put the human into it because they're reluctant to cede that over. So I think you're right. From a regulatory standpoint, yes. I will also tell you the computer generates 30 pages of four font type, and I'm supposed to read that and sign that. And I will tell you, as a practical matter, I sign a lot of stuff that I can barely read because the computer can make more words than I can read.
Of course.
And so
I'm telling you, we are. And the reason that makes all those words is to cover all those other things that we're talking about.
Right.
The regulatory, the...
If the chatbot does that and the computer generates a 30-page document explaining everything that the chatbot considered, and I'm supposed to sign that, and that's my job, I will probably sign the 30 pages. So it could happen without effective human oversight, even though the regulations don't allow it without effective human oversight. Because I'll tell you, doctors right now, I would just tell you, I know this, are signing a lot of things. You know, we have to figure out, we have to prioritize taking care of patients. And there's a lot of documentation that comes out of computers that has to be signed and has no relevance whatsoever.
And so how much of what we just discussed for the last minute is good? Right? I mean,
yeah,
everything
absolutely.
You just said should terrify people.
Right. You can't read a computer printout. I mean, it just contains so much
stuff.
When was
the last time that I'm going to call it a UEA, a user agreement, right? When was the last time a user agreement popped up when you were on your computer and you didn't just click OK?
Right.
When did you ever read the whole thing?
Yeah, you sign your Apple agreement, then I'm going to read the entire assessment plan from all the therapists. That is the type of thing we're looking at. Simply can't do all that and actually still take care of patients.
And so the fact that we can breeze through those types of documents and just click through them, all it takes now is a computer to go, you know what, we gave that Dr. Weaver character a 30-page document. He got the document, and 8 seconds later, he signed it. Boy, how could he read that four font for 3 pages? Now you got an attorney in the court saying, well, how did you – I mean, next thing – I'm just saying – our systems just aren't ready for this. So we can test it. We can proof of concept it. We can give it to people to use as an information source, but it can never be the authoritative source on medical care delivery.
Yeah. From my standpoint, the simple answer, rather than I don't want to leave the radio fans with the feeling that I'm callous, but the simple answer is then I have to focus my attention on the things that are important for my patients. And so signing documents of plans that have already been enacted for documentation, I don't want to waste my time on that. I need to focus on the things that might actively impact my patient's care.
And unfortunately, with that
amount of written information, I have to make choices because there's no way I can read it all.
And I still believe that right now, in this era we're in right now, computers have to augment your information source and give you accurate and believable information that you can make good decisions with. And if you try to let it make the decisions, again, our system's going to fail. This system's just going to break apart.
This May 24th from the ONC, the Office of I forgot what that office is. It's looking at the Department of Health and Human Services National Health Information Trends Survey, and they surveyed people how they use electronic devices between 2017 and 2018. Found that 49% of smartphone or tablet owners have a health and wellness app. 75% track progress on a health-related goal, 48% made a treatment decision or for an illness or condition, and 45% discussed health with a healthcare provider. Additionally, 28% use a health and wellness app or other electronic monitoring device, share that information with their health professional.
Do you believe those numbers?
No, it was a survey.
I'm going to ask you a question. There are three of us sitting in this room right now. That represents 33% each. Did you do that year?
No, I have not.
Neither did I. Did you? No. So right now, I can tell you the numbers are flawed.
According to the Rick Phillips Health Survey, this is garbage.
Here's the thing, Tony. Android, Apple, all of them, the default devices come with a health app preloaded.
Gotcha.
So yeah, it's there. It's tracking your steps. You may never activate it or may never interact with it, but it's there. And you're telling me how many kids today have health apps that they actually are using?
Rick, you're killing me on this technology.
Well, then quit
bringing
this stuff. This stuff is crazy.
All right.
This is what happens when somebody who doesn't understand technology, doesn't implement it and use it in their life every day, tries to study it.
Well, now you're getting personal.
I am. If you're not one of the people tracking your health with an app, you probably shouldn't be looking at this data.
For our radio fans, I'll just keep moving on then. Something else that I'm not doing right now, Pitt and Carnegie Mellon created a robotic trauma care system for combat casualties. This also May 24th.
I'm in favor of this one.
All right, you like it. It's called, here it is.
I'm in favor of this one.
It's called Trauma Care in a Rucksack. And Rick says, okay, the military uses the term rucksack.
It's a German, it's derived from a German origin. I think the word rucken is means
carry.
Back. No, it means back.
Okay.
And
so
I think
it's a back sack.
Well, sack in German is bag, so it's a back bag. But
I'm sorry, but why would you? I mean, and you say in the military,
we use rucksack
are
all the time.
Rucksacks.
No. We don't even know what a backpack is. You get issued a rucksack, period.
You wonder why they're speaking German in the military. Is this? Do I need to? This is what we need to be investigating here on
Health
Matters.
I don't know.
Why are we using German backpacks?
I had 4 years of active military and 4 years of active reserve, and we had a rucksack the entire time.
All right. It will implement artificial intelligence into a backpack size kit to enable potentially life saving medical interventions. This is what they want to do. They're going to create a robotic suit and put it in a rucksack. When an injured soldier is placed in the suit, embedded monitors will assess the injury so that artificial intelligence algorithms can determine appropriate interventions and robotically deliver intravenous fluids and other medications. So basically, you go down on the battlefield, I strap on the trauma care in a rucksack suit, and it looks at your injuries, it decides what's got circulation, what doesn't, starts IV fluids, may put pressure on a wound or something like that to stop bleeding. It does all that. It's a autonomous or nearly autonomous. You don't have to activate it from the hospital, trauma center, or anything else. It works on its own.
So it's interesting, Tony, if I may, the military medicine is the one place where everything we've just been talking about
can happen,
can actually work. Yeah. Because they're not limited to red tape and bureaucratic regulations and legal things. When you're in combat, anything goes.
So you look at this, then, obviously, just like most military things that are not necessarily weapons or ammo or nuclear, this thing could spin off into the private sector.
So let me give you something that comes to mind. I know you're familiar with a Cell Saver, right?
Right.
So Cell Savers were, as I was told, Cell Savers were designed for combat medicine.
Right.
Right. To harvest blood and clean the cells and
right.
put them
if
back
in the patient. If you were in surgery, we need to keep that blood because we're not going to have a bunch of blood to transfuse, and that's somebody else's blood anyway. Why don't we just recycle your blood? If we suck it out of a wound, then we clean it and we transfuse it back into you. That's the idea of a Cell Saver, and it went from a military battlefield, as you said. I'm taking your word for it, but we see it now in civilian surgeries because it's better than getting a transfusion of someone else's blood.
So I was military trained on these, and they said even if they come in with their helmet, if you can capture any of the blood around the patient, even in their helmet, bring it in, they'll suck it into the Cell Saver, and they'll try to spin it and clean it and basically recycle it so that they can put it back in the patient.
Now, you see where this is going then. You could see how this would come out of the military, hikers, mountain climbers, people in
space.
Remote places, yeah, astronauts and so forth.
When we go to Mars, this will be a great way
right.
to deal with
and
things
And then you
Mars.
Can also see then, going forward, just like we have a phone in a suitcase phone you used to plug into your car,
right.
And then we move to cell phones, you could see how this whole thing in a rucksack could wind up being your shirt.
Exactly.
Your shirt could wind up...
Or if you're talking about the military, your uniform you're already wearing
right.
is this built into it.
Yeah.
Absolutely, Tony. So that's what I'm saying. I can get on board with stuff like this because, again, they have an environment that's kind of away from the social norm.
So you can see here, I've got three very logical, reasonable interventions that Rick shot down two of them for, I think we can all agree, rather sketchy reasons. We had chatbots that could help with triage and determine whether you should go to the clinic or the ER, what you should do. We have smartphone apps that Rick feels that everybody has one, so nobody uses them. And then we have the trauma care in a rucksack and that Rick embraces. And I think we both think this is going to be something that's probably going to be useful in the future.
Well, I think it has merit. I think it will evolve quicker because it has less regulatory problems. And again, I like chatbots. Don't get me wrong. I think chatbots have their place in everything. I think, you know, I've used one to, you know, find people in the organization. Like if I'm at UK, I can log into one of our particular programs we use and I can type who is so-and-so. And the chatbot will go off and it'll find some information about somebody on the staff, and it'll pull me back a picture and show me, you know. So there's things that I can do with chatbots that are great. Travel bots. Hey, I'm going to California next week. I'm going to be staying here. What hotels are available? Boom, it just spits it back for you. I'm totally in favor of that. I'm not suggesting it's a bad idea. I'm saying we're not ready for it. So don't make everybody hate me because I'm, you know.
You can hate Rick for other reasons.
Now, the middle one, the health app. People do use them. I just think the numbers are skewed. I think the numbers aren't accurate.
I've got a couple of folks tracking their diabetes and blood pressure. That's
sure.
where I see
no,
a lot of
I
it.
I totally believe that people check their health. I actually stand on a scale that logs mine into a weight app. But I don't know that necessarily I would say 45% of everybody who owns a mobile device is tracking their health because I think that's just a wrong number.
Yeah, that's a whole other
especially show. Tracking their health with the intent to do something about
right.
it.
Right. And what happens to the numbers that you send into the company? Do they keep them? Do they sell them?
There's,
that's another show.
Let's be honest, Tony. There's weighing yourself, and there's intent-based weighing yourself.
Yeah. You just it's like a helicopter flyover. Every once in a while, you just have to see how bad things are.
Every once in a while, you got to know how to answer that question on the questionnaire.
We'll be back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the one final show until summer hiatus initiates. It's the Of Sushi, because that's just the way the letters work out. I didn't try to do that. That's just, you know, you just put the letters up. There they are. It's sort of like the A, B, C, C, D, D, E of cardiovascular risk.
I've already forgotten that.
Yeah, I know.
Please tell me we're not going to go through that again.
Absolutely we are, because we are Health Matters.
We're repetitive motion radio.
Absolutely. All right, here we go. This is the new 2019 primary cardiovascular prevention. We have given up on our Life Simple 7. We have given up on the four food groups, and now we are in the A, B, C, D, E, except some of the letters repeat themselves and some of them don't stand for what they say. That's their latest thing. A stands for assess risk and aspirin. Aspirin only in high-risk groups, not people of average risk over age 70, and not people of average risk, in fact, at any age. Also, assessing the risk, you can search the American Heart Association, or AHA, risk calculator, and you can plug in your blood pressure, your age, and your cholesterol numbers and find out your 10-year risk of having a heart attack. It is a good place to start. That at least helps you. And, you know, Rick, I got to say, that helps you to make intelligent decisions about medicines, sort of. I have had some of my patients, I've said, look, here's your risk. You've got a 21% risk of having a heart attack in the next 10 years. And they just are in shock. They're not making intelligent decisions. I have just ruined their day and probably ruined quite a bit of their life because I told them they were high risk for a heart attack.
Right.
And so I've wondered, I mean, I'm supposed to calculate and inform every one of my patients what their heart attack, their 10-year risk is, but some of them, it seems like I am not helping them out. I'm just scaring them with this information. But assess risk and aspirin, that's A.
But, I mean, let's be honest. You've been scaring patients since you were just out of med school, right?
Well, actually, I was scaring them before I even went to med school. What's that over there?
You're a lifelong.
I'm a lifelong generator of horror. Thanks for pointing that out. But B is for blood pressure. American Heart Association, less than 130 over 80. Again, the American College of Physicians, less than 140 over 90, with some exceptions there as well. They are both looking at the same data. They came up with different conclusions. Talk to your healthcare provider and pick the blood pressure that target that is right for you. C is cholesterol. C is cigarettes. Stop the cigarettes. Control the cholesterol. D is diet weight. I'm not making this up. I don't know how you can get weight out of D. I just don't think you can do it. But I guess if you have a diet, it affects your weight. But what they mean is, you know, you've got to have a good diet. That is, you've got to eat the right foods, but you also have to maintain your weight. That's two separate things, one of which does not begin with the letter D, but it's under D.
Yeah, I was trying to see if I could fit dearth in there, but, you know, I don't think that works either.
Well, it is dumb with a D. D is also for diabetes, though. That's the second D, or maybe it's the third D if you think weight's a D. I don't know which it is. Diabetes, again, control through diet and exercise is the ideal way. And keep in mind, the medicines, for many of us who get the type 2 diabetes, the kind we get as we get older, the medicines are sort of a crutch, sort of a Band-Aid that you use while you need to control your diet and your weight to control the diabetes. And they are not a substitute in terms of your health for maintaining the correct weight, achieving and maintaining it. E stands for exercise and exercise only, 150 minutes per week. Moderate exercise, that's exercise where you can actually talk to Rick. And then 75 minutes of vigorous physical activity where you don't have to talk to Rick at all. That is our sponsor, the ABCs and Ds and Es and also Ws, primary cardiovascular prevention. I got some information. I'll just put it that way. This is from Bert Mendelbaum. He is, and I picked this up on one of my RSS feeds. Learning from our ancestors to regain the American lifespan. You got to, with a title like that, you got to read this thing. So this is what he says as of May 11th. In 2017, the U.S. life expectancy decreased for the third year in a row. It looks maybe like a blip, maybe a three-year blip, but it is a blip. Other nations had a decline in 2015 because of severe influenza and a bad influenza outbreak. We had a pretty bad one in 2015. That can do it. But the other developed countries bounced back. Their life expectancies increased. The U.S. did not. 3 years in a row, we have been consecutively dropping our average life expectancy. We don't live as long as we did in 2015. It was concentrated in people younger than 65 years. So it is not that the old people are departing prematurely. It is that the young people are departing prematurely, losing a lot of life expectancy. Other developed countries.
Do you think any of that was related to the release of Pokemon Go, where people were walking around just looking, not looking in traffic?
Absolutely not. You bait me with this sort of stuff. You say, you know, the greatest threat to American health right now is Pokemon Go, and I'm saying no. No, that's what I would expect from a technology.
Because that was right when that game got popular, and you know, and a lot of people were walking around in traffic.
Right. Now, what we have, for those of us who are still living on this planet, is we have opioid overdoses, which have claimed more and more American lives. They were concentrated in our rural eastern Kentucky and West Virginia areas. Now they have, in fact, become a problem across the country, robbing us of a lot of vital young people, and that drops our life expectancy. Also, high rates of obesity, kind of going paralleling that, and the diseases of obesity, which cause premature death. For men in particular, most of the increase was external causes, accidents, violence, and other environmental factors. Any way you look at it, though, we're not living as long as we should. And in my mind, the fundamental responsibility of our healthcare system is to make us live longer.
And you're going to leave that in the hands of a chat bot.
I feel bad about that, but fortunately, you won't allow it to happen anyway. In 1960... we had the highest life expectancy in the world, 2.4 years above the average of the what you would call developed nations. We had, by 2.4 years above average, we had the highest average life expectancy in the world in 1960. Now, you got to think about that, because in 1960, the Surgeon General's report had not come out yet. We were smoking like nobody's business.
Sure. So was everybody else, though.
Yeah, but we were... In the 1980s, the rest of the developed world caught up. By the 1980s, our life expectancy was average. By 1998, we were below average. And by 2012, we stopped climbing at all, and we're now 1.5 years less than average. We went from 1960 up to 2012. We went from highest in the world to 1.5 years less than the average for developed countries.
What am I supposed to make? I mean, we're U.S. bad.
As early as 2000,
everybody else good.
As early as 2005, researchers predicted that if we continued to if our rates of obesity continued to increase, it would start affecting our life expectancy in the first half of this century, and in fact, it did. Obesity-related death did increase in 2015. But also non-obesity related, and these are the other things. They call them deaths of despair. This is drug overdose, alcohol, and suicide. These have increased over the past 15 years, especially in white men ages 45 to 54. So again, these are younger men that are dying of what they call deaths of despair. Alcohol, well documented. It has been steadily increasing. It declined until 2006, and now it is rising again. And this is what Bert Mendelbaum says. He says, if we're going to stop these deaths of despair, we need policies to combat the causes and help those left out of the American dream. Better support for education. How's that coming in Kentucky?
Yeah.
Broader distribution of economic opportunity. How's that coming? And increased availability of health care and mental health resources, particularly in the distressed populations such as we have in our rural areas. And so, you know, one, this was very discouraging. as you see us tumble from essentially the longest life expectancy in the world to below average and continuing to fall. And two, the solutions are things that we have studiously avoided addressing. So we've got, there is a new medicine out, just released the day we recorded this, a $2.1 million genetic treatment for a certain type of spinal cord disease. So we will spend that kind of money on those medicines, and we will not address the things that are shortening our life expectancy. Very discouraging. That's what we do in our third and final fractional portion.
As we bring people back down to earth?
Yeah, we...
Wouldn't it be nice if we had some little single piece of research that could explain all this? The problem is it's complex, you know. When you reduce your lung cancer rates, you increase, you know, something some other bottleneck or some other problem kind of surfaces. And what I was going to say is it reminds me of that game called Whack-A-Mole. Right, I mean, mm-hmm. we're just whacking away at things, and we hit them, and we knock them down, and then something else pops up, and the thing is, apparently the moles are coming so fast, we can't actually increase in the lifespan.
Right. Well, you look at the education issue, for instance. I mean, that we know that education and socioeconomic status, but really education has a lot to do with a person's life expectancy, and we are cheating education right now to pay for other things that we feel are more pressing. And so not only are we losing life expectancy now, but we are creating a very fertile area for additional loss in life expectancy. We're not even doing the things we were doing 5 years ago. And 5 years ago, we were not doing the things that we should have been doing to maintain parity with the rest of the developed countries in the world. So this is I just have the sense that we've lost our way. We have been, you've heard me speak over and over again about the electronic medical record. We have worked on quality improvement. We've worked on new drug development, genetic technologies, the electronic medical record. We have kept our, studiously kept our eyes off the simple things we must do as a society to help our citizens live longer. And I'm frustrated, and obviously I'm talking about it on the radio because I do not think there is a thing that we can do at this point realistically that will affect this. And I do not think even the chatbots, Rick.
No,
even the chatbots can't reserve.
No, but I think that, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, on this same very show, we were probably talking about how critical the decision that was made to push everybody to a mandated electronic medical record system, right? So that was something that came out in the Obama era, is you had to move. They put a deadline if you weren't doing medical care electronically, that you could submit and file claims and paperwork that you weren't going to get paid by the federal government, which was a good enough enticement to make everybody do it. I think we knew then that was a good decision, that we had to progress. I think we knew the implementation was going to be rocky. The way that we kind of standardized with no real standardization established, was going to make it hard to get everybody on the same page. And I think what you're seeing now, Tony, is I think you're seeing kind of that evolution of that electronic medical record, which makes things harder before they get better.
I certainly agree with that.
And so right now you're seeing 30, 40% reduction in productivity. What does that do in Eastern Kentucky? That takes 30 or 40% of the healthcare that was already in a shortage status and making it even more shortage, right? So we're tasking the system. At some point, we will get that critical mass. We will get that standardization. We will get some move that will make this stuff start playing better together that will actually bring forth some benefit and solve some problems.
How many people have to die before that happens?
Well, I don't know, Tony. How many people died of lung cancer before we decided to say it actually was cancer? It actually caused cancer. I mean, I'm not suggesting that we delay. I'm saying, you know, the U.S. and the world and health, I mean, some of this stuff is, they're just hard problems. They're complex. They're multifaceted. No single piece of research is going to describe them or solve them. And in some sense, we have to be diligent but patient.
Yeah.
And that's hard for you as a person who've devoted your life to saving people. That's hard for you to deal with.
Yeah, we're losing ground.
Are we losing ground or gaining people?
No, we're certainly not gaining people.
Everything you're doing is per capita. It's not based on a bolus of boomers that are now starting to get to old age.
No, no, not at all. Not at all. Absolutely not. This is a degradation in our ability to live a long and productive life. And you look around and you know it, Rick. I mean, the levels of obesity are higher than ever before. The general health has deteriorated. Access to medical care has deteriorated, again, because of the loss in productivity. We have been preoccupied with some of these advances that haven't turned out to be all that advanced.
Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
as many as half of all people ages 85 and older may have some form of Health Matters. As the U.S. population continues to age, the prevalence of Health Matters is expected to rise with a corresponding increase in related spending.
Current Health Matters drugs have shown limited efficacy. Two types of drugs have been approved by the U.S. FDA for treatment of Health Matters symptoms. Clinical evidence indicates that these drugs may delay cognitive impairment for approximately 3 to 12 months among certain adults with Health Matters, while others may not benefit at all.
The evidence supporting Health Matters drugs' effect on cognitive impairment is typically based on cognitive test results and not on real-world behavior. These drugs, in combination or separately, have not been shown to appreciably delay initial institutionalization, improve quality of life, or lessen caregiver burden.
There is some research that indicates a small subset of patients may see meaningful benefit from using Health Matters drugs, although such results remain subject to debate.
Despite a lack of clinical evidence supporting the practice, many clinicians continue to prescribe Health Matters drugs long-term at a substantial cost to patients and overall healthcare system.
Whatever you do, do not take healthcare's lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.